Talk about your flat world society. Archie Freeman did not believe that there could still be a fighter carrier floating out somewhere around his planet. It took some arm twisting, but Ray talked him and three of the elders into a trip to the broadcast discs. We would show them that the discs were dead, do a radar sweep to see if we could find any trace of the fighter carrier, and maybe look around. Ray Freeman did not come for the ride. Archie looked around the cabin nervously.
You know, I always wondered what it was like to go up in one of these. Self-broadcasters remind me of the early days of airplanes and daredevils flying through barns.
Do you understand how self-broadcasting works? It will be just like flying into a broadcast disc.
The broadcast discs were destroyed.
Not destroyed, just unplugged.
They don't have power.
Right. This ship can broadcast itself. There will be an electrical field around the ship right before we broadcast. It's supposed to be there. There will be a bright flash, and when we come out, we'll be near the broadcast discs.
What if we run into that carrier?
We could, but I'm betting that they went to the discs, found them dead, and have already turned back toward Little Man.
Delphi.
Excuse me?
We call the planet Delphi.
You're right. Sorry.
What happens if we run into that carrier? I don't see any guns on your ship.
No, I don't have any.
Can you outrun a carrier?
I hit the button to start charging the broadcast engine.
Not a chance. Those ships hit 30 million per hour. I might be able to do 6 million miles at best.
So what will we do?
Look, Archie, it's a big galaxy. You don't run into ships out here by accident. You can go out looking for other ships and never see them. If you and I were the only people on Delphi, what do you think the chances would be of our accidentally running into each other? The galaxy is a billion times bigger than Delphi. Okay, I'm gonna broadcast us now.
I brought up the tent shield.
What's that? The window went black.
It's a tent shield. It protects your eyes. Things get bright out there when you broadcast. Unless you tint the windows, the brightness will blind you.
Oh, okay.
We're here.
Out of habit, I started up the generator to charge the broadcast engine the moment we arrived. That habit saved our lives. We arrived just a few miles from the broadcast discs and drifted over to see them. Coming to an almost dead stop, I took the Starliner around the defunct discs.
Those are the discs?
That is the broadcast station.
You fly into it?
You fly toward it. It sends out an energy field to transport your ship.
Oh, I see.
If the discs were live, they would have a white glow, there would be traffic lights and warning lights along the top. There's not so much as a vault of electricity in this station.
As I reached to turn on the radar display, the Harrier buzzed us. It was a gray-white blur that streaked past the cockpit and totally vanished.
Good God, what was that?
I switched on the radar with one hand and pulled the wheel sharp to the right with the other.
Hold on.
What's going on? What was that?
You asked me what would happen if we ran into that carrier. We just did.
I don't see anything.
Archie, that ship travels 30 million miles per hour. They could come right up our nose and ram us before you see them if they wanted.
Do they want to kill us?
We'd already be dead if they did. That was a fighter. The pilot could flame us with a single shot if he wanted.
I glanced at the broadcast gear. It would need another 2 minutes of charging before I could use it. The Harrier did not come up on us from behind. It slowed so that we would see it, flashed over the top of the Starliner, and vanished into space. The radar tracked its path.
They're not going to shoot us yet.
Well, how do you know that?
They're stuck out here, and the broadcast station is down, right? They'll want to know how we got here before they start shooting. If they figure out that we're self-broadcasting, they'll want to capture our ship.
Unidentified spacecraft. This is the UAN Grant. Identify yourself.
The Grant.
I knew the ship.
What are we going to do?
They want to know how we got here. I'm going to show them.
An amber light winked on above the broadcast engine to show that it was ready. I had already programmed in the coordinates for Little Man, and now I initiated the broadcast.
Raymond was right.
Archie looked dejected. His arms hung at his side as he spoke. His head hung at a slight tilt.
That carrier did not make it through the broadcast disc. It will not arrive at Delphi today, and it may not come back for a week. But sooner or later, it will return.
I sat alone in a corner in the back of the town hall, ready to leave. Freeman sat with Marianne and her son. They sat one row behind the rest of the congregation. They were with the people, but not part of them.
Raymond believes that we should leave this planet. He believes that the Philistines are at the gate, and we must abandon our promised land. God has promised us deliverance. We will not abandon our planet. I have seen the enemy with my own eyes. His fighters are as fast as light. But we must not fear the puny arm of man, for God will protect us.
Archie launched into a prayer. In that prayer, he gave thanks for the planet of Delphi. Still praying, Archie said that Ray and I were led to the planet by God so that we could be instruments of deliverance. We were tools in God's hand. When the meeting ended, I went to Ray.
How could you ever live with these people?
He shrugged his shoulders and walked away.
Wason, this is Caleb. This is my boy.
Marianne rested her hands on the shoulder of a young man who stood just a tad under 6 feet tall. His head came up to my nose.
Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Mr. Harris.
Archie came and tapped me on the shoulder.
May I speak with you?
I nodded, grateful for the escape. Archie led me to a quiet corner of the room.
Mr. Harris, you and Raymond did not need to come here. No one asked you to help us, but you came. And now, once again, we are asking you to extend your generosity.
It's okay. Coming here was Ray's idea. You should thank him.
He says it's your ship.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to thank you.
Can I ask you a question?
Anything.
Archie Freeman stood silent and still as a tree and stared into my eyes.
No, son. I don't believe you have a soul.
Science can create life, but it cannot create a soul? Is that what you believe?
Science cannot create life.
I'm alive, and I'm a work of science.
I am not trying to judge you, Mr. Harris.
Don't judge me. Judge science. I crawled out of a tube, not a womb. What does your gospel say about that?
Mr. Harris, I don't pretend to understand cloning. I am a minister, and I have spent the last 50 years of my life on barren planets, cut off from men and the galaxy.
But you don't think science can create life through cloning?
Cloning doesn't create life. It duplicates it. If I have a fire, and you hold a stick over the flames until it catches on fire as well, you haven't created a new fire. You've simply borrowed a flame from me. They didn't create life when they made you, Mr. Harris. They borrowed genes from one of God's creations, somebody who had a soul. You got his hair and his skin and his eyes, but I do not believe you got his soul. And I don't believe his soul was embedded in that DNA. Now, I think it's real nice that you and Raymond came to rescue us. And I am grateful that you have been so generous. You appear to be a man of great virtue. Though, if you are associated with my son, you are probably a professional killer. But unless science has identified the gene that holds the soul, I see no reason to believe that you are anything more or less than a temporal man, a body with an earthly spark of life, and no chance for eternity.
Archie turned and walked away. Marianne walked around the corner.
That's not exactly what he told everybody else about you.
You were listening?
He's my father.
And that makes eavesdropping all right.
Yes. Yes, it does.
What did he say to everybody else?
The night you landed, we held a town meeting.
I know. I was there for some of it. I left and you followed me and we talked?
No, that was an open meeting. After you and Raymond left, Archie held a closed meeting just for the men.
And you listened in?
Do you want to hear what he said or not?
What did he say?
People were scared of you. They said that cloning is an abomination. Archie said that incest is an abomination.
Well, that makes me feel better.
You don't understand. Do you read the Bible?
Do you follow current events on the media link?
Wason, you're such an ass.
Sorry.
Have you heard of Lot?
Sodom and Gomorrah. His wife looked back and turned into a pillar of salt. You don't need to read the Bible to know that story.
Do you know that after his wife died, Lot's daughters got him drunk and seduced him? They had two sons, and both sons created nations.
Unless they were cloned, I don't see what that has to do with me.
One of those nations was Moab. A woman from Moab married a Jew. Her great-grandson was King David.
So? What does any of that have to do with cloning?
Jesus was a descendant of David. Had it not been for Lot's daughters, Jesus would not have been born. Don't you see, Archie justified you? He said that righteous ends can come from evil means.
The errand was not dangerous. All I was doing was broadcasting out to the middle of nowhere to take some radar readings and locate the Grant. Ray came into the cockpit. The last people onto the Starliner were Archie and Caleb, Marianne's son. Over the last few days, Caleb had become my shadow, my helper, and my unofficial second-in-command. The boy was 12 years old, far too tall for his age, and headed toward another growth spurt. He liked to ask questions and watched his surroundings with great curiosity.
Go sit back there.
Ray pointed back to the cabin. Caleb and Archie sat on the same row.
He's adopting you. You know that, don't you?
I don't know much about families. Is that what they call it?
When a fatherless boy starts following you around, he's looking for more than a friend.
Ray glanced out the window at Marianne, who was standing in the door of the meeting house.
She and Caleb are alone. Unless you want to live here, little man, you better let Marianne know you're not here to stay.
You lost me. Let's square things with the Grant, then we can talk family.
Harris, this colony is a different world from your old clone farm. Nothing goes to waste here.
Meaning?
Marianne is looking for a husband. Her boy needs a father, and you're available.
I'm a clone.
You see any other options?
She could come with us. We could take him to Earth or to some other planet.
She doesn't want to get out. She wants to bring you in.
Ray, the boy is just coming along for the ride.
Just know what you're getting into. Marianne isn't just scrub you met on the beach.
Having delivered his warning, Ray left the cockpit and climbed out of the ship. I performed the final checks of my instruments and took off. I quickly flew the Starliner out of Little Man's atmosphere and into deep space.
Caleb, you want to sit up here?
Caleb's smile brightened and he trotted into the cockpit. He sat in the co-pilot's seat. Archie stood hunched in the door of the cockpit. Caleb and he watched every move I made as I pressed buttons and flipped switches. When I powered up the broadcast computer, Caleb's face lit up.
What is that?
This is the reason we can still travel when the rest of the galaxy is stuck in one place. This is a broadcast computer. It lets us go places without having to fly there.
Without having to fly?
I tell this computer where I want to go, and it puts us right there.
That's the part that scares me.
How do you tell it where to go?
I showed him how to translate interactive maps into coordinates.
The computer has coordinates for every star and planet in the galaxy. And the hard part is if you want to fly to a pinpoint location, like a certain spot right above a planet, you don't always aim at something big like a planet. Sometimes you have to fine-tune it.
Like, into deep space? Like where we are now?
There used to be a space station called the Golan Dry Docks. It was top secret. If you wanted to broadcast yourself there, you needed to put in the coordinates yourself. You heard there was a war, right? That was the reason your uncle and I came to Delphi?
A war against Earth?
Yes, and Earth had this giant ship called the Doctrinaire. It was bigger and stronger than any other ship in the galaxy. It was so strong that it could destroy whole fleets of enemy ships. And it had special shields, so no other ship could hurt it.
So, Earth used it to win the war?
No. Earth lost. The people attacking Earth destroyed that ship with a single shot, and they did it with a computer like this.
How can you destroy a ship with a computer?
The shields of the Doctrinaire were so strong that nothing could get through them, right? And its cannons were so powerful that it could pick off any ship that came within range. But the captain of the Doctrinaire kept the ship in one place while the smaller ships in his fleet chased the enemy.
Why did he do that?
Well, he was smart. Big ships are not maneuverable. They get into trouble when they move out of position. So Thurston, he used the Doctrinaire like a floating fortress. He wanted to trap the enemy with the Doctrinaire on one side and his cruisers and battleships on the other. He never saw anything like it. It looked like the Doctrinaire was falling asleep. The ship slid out of formation, and all of a sudden, it just blows up. See, the Mogats? They knew Thurston liked to leave his ship in one place.
You're not saying that they broadcasted another ship into it. They killed themselves?
And they took the whole damned Unified Authority with them. They had a nuclear bomb aboard, but that was just overkill. The anomaly from the broadcast engine probably killed everyone aboard all on its own.
Wow. And ships can pass through shields when you broadcast them?
Yeah, I don't understand how it works. I guess they kind of just appear. I don't think that cruiser passed through the shields. I think it just appeared inside the other ship.
So, it's like you're dead when you're broadcasting. It's like you don't exist for a moment, and then you come back to life.
Ain't safe enough. Billions and billions of people have done it.
But you couldn't just point to a spot and aim using the computer. How do they know they would hit that ship?
I told him about triangulation and how you can calculate an exact target using X, Y, and Z coordinates. Caleb was 12 years old, and he understood the math far better than me. Archie didn't seem interested. He went back to the passenger cabin. Clones are sterile. The military class was never meant to have children. This idea was old when Christ was born. Plato, upon whose writings the Unified Authority's social structure was based, believed that warriors should live in communes and that their children should be shared. In modern days, military clones were raised in orphanages, and they were incapable of having children of their own. Marianne provided me an escape clause from Plato's society. She came with a ready-made family. And best of all, I liked the boy. 5 days had passed since the day Archie and I had flown out and seen the Grant. Marianne and I began taking late-night walks every evening. We would sit and I would stare into the sky and tell her stories about planets and battles. I told her about Ezra Cree and the Japanese. I told her about Bryce Kleiber and how he died so needlessly. Sometimes I searched space for signs of battle between the Mogats and Confederate arms. They were out there somewhere, killing each other. More than once, she asked me if I cared who won that war, and I told her that I did not. I lied. I wanted both sides to destroy each other. But if one side had to survive, I preferred a universe with the Confederate arms rather than Morgan Atkins and his fanatics. But on this particular night, Marianne said something that sent a warm thrill through me.
Caleb talks about you all the time. He loves you, Ethan. And I love you.
I turned toward her, and we kissed. We remained outside, sitting on a bench overlooking the farm, exchanging childish kisses and holding hands. She may or may not have known that I wanted more, but she did not offer it to me.
I love you, Ethan.
I wanted to tell Marianne that I loved her, but I was not sure I knew how to love.
How do you feel about me and Caleb?
I never had a family. I don't know about love or father-son relations. I like spending time with Caleb. It's funny. I like to teach him things. I like it when he asks me questions.
You're the closest thing he's ever had to a father. How about me, Wason? How do you feel about me?
She punctuated that question with a longer, more passionate kiss than the childish kisses she had been giving me.
Will you stay?
A life of farming. She might as well have asked me to spend the rest of my life in prison.
Stay with us. Stay with me.
I don't know.
Wason.
I was made for war. I don't know if there's anything else in me. I can't become a Neo-Baptist farmer. I simply don't know how.
She pulled her face away from mine, but she did not pull away.
I'll take you and Caleb with me wherever I go. It can be just like Ruth. Where thou goest, I goest. Something like that.
Oh, Wason, you don't understand.
I did understand. I just could not do anything about it. The Grant might have attacked earlier, except they could not risk hurting my Starliner. For the last week, Caleb and I had broadcasted out and located the Grant every day. It was coming closer. Sometimes it traveled at a mere 10 million miles per hour, one-third of its best speed. A few times, it stopped altogether. The crew was taking its time. The congregation slept as families in dome-shaped temporary dwellings that looked like blisters on the ground. I would have liked to have slept with Marianne, but no one offered. Ray and I continued to sleep on the reclining passenger seats inside the Starliner. Caleb slept with us. Caleb was fast asleep. Ray and I did not sleep so soundly. We had our seats back and our feet up. Perhaps I unconsciously noticed the movements through the window beside my seat. Something woke me from my sleep, and I turned to look. Outside, the moon lit the clearing with pale gray light. We were on the edge of a forest, and I saw the silhouettes of trees swaying in the background. I saw rows of dome-shaped temporary housing shelters, sophisticated tents, rising out of the ground like snowy moguls. Lights burned in a few of those tents. It was not the tents or the trees that I focused on when I woke up. It was the phantoms that caught my attention. They looked like phantoms. Men dressed in UA Marine combat armor, sifting their way through the tents. To me, they looked like the ghosts of the Battle of Little Man, risen from the valley and come to collect us. When I woke, there might have been 15 of these spectral Marines moving forward slowly. As I watched, more of these men emerged from the woods behind the camp. Apparently, they had hiked in from a landing site on the other side of the trees.
Ray, you seeing this?
How many?
I'm guessing 42.
There were 42 men in a platoon. Freeman fitted his armored chest pad over his head and shoulders, then pulled out his arsenal. He chose an automatic rifle, a pistol, and three grenades. I took my M27. Some of the Marines waited at the other end of the campsite in case the people in the tents came out. The rest of the men walked in past the tents and started across the open ground toward my ship. I knew the Marines outside the ship would not be able to see into the Starliner, not even with all the nifty lenses in their helmets. But I ran to the cockpit in a crouch.
I'm going to level the playing field.
Turn on the lights.
Neither of us bothered to tell the other what we both knew. They had come for the Starliner. They had come to take my free ticket to any place in the galaxy. I powered up the control console and looked at the readout. Sure enough, it showed a UA battleship flying above the atmosphere.
Anything on the radar?
By now, the men were close, less than 10 feet from the ship. I could see them squatting, hustling into position.
They have a battleship about 1,000 miles up.
I lit the landing lights, flooding the entire settlement area with bright, blinding light. Tint shields in the Marines' visors would protect their eyes from the glare. They could stare right into the light and it would not bother them. Most of the Marines dropped to the ground or looked for cover. Three ran to the ship, and Ray accommodated them by opening the hatch. The dead men formed a small pile at the base of the ship. Outside the Starliner, people climbed out of their tents, looking absolutely terrified. I never knew that negotiation was among Freeman's skills, but his technique was impeccable. First, he dropped a grenade down the ramp. It rolled smoothly, plunked on the three dead men, then continued to roll to the ground.
That one still has its pin.
What's happening?
One of the Marines ventured forward to verify this. He picked up the grenade, examined it. Freeman shot him in the head.
Oh, God!
This one doesn't have a pin.
He did not toss the grenade down the ramp this time. He tossed the pin.
Do I have your attention?
Freeman and his grenade remained in the Starliner. Caleb came out with me. Most of the Marines acted nonchalant as I stepped down the ramp. A few trained their guns on me, but most stood their ground, carefully watching my every twitch. Caleb walked at my side, a couple of feet away from me. He did not whimper or cry. He did not cringe, but he took tentative steps, like a man walking on thin ice.
We have a standoff!
What do you want?
I want you to leave, but you can't do that, can you?
A Marine stepped forward and removed his helmet. I did not like what I saw. He held his M27 in his right hand. In his left, he gripped his helmet by the lip as if it were a bucket. He was a clone, of course. The man may have been in his late 30s, a veteran, so to speak. His eyes had that calculated confidence you generally saw in the eyes of veteran Marines. But there was something odd about him. His eyelids rode high on his eyes, showing whites both above and below his pupils. He had a nervous tic, which caused him to glance to the sides. Like me, the man had brown hair and brown eyes. He stood just under 6 feet tall. Something else caught my attention. The man looked emaciated, as if he hadn't eaten for weeks. This was not the thin face of a man who eats sparingly. This was the bony face of a man who had lost a lot of weight in a very short time. It had only been 2 weeks since the network was destroyed. Even on a ship trapped in a remote part of the galaxy, the pantries should have had enough inventory to last for months.
You think you're in control, don't you, asswipe?
That depends how badly you want my ship.
Who says I want your ship? Maybe I just want to poke a few women and go home.
Marianne stood outside her tent, watching all of this anxiously. She took little stuttering steps as if she wanted to start running to Caleb, then she pulled herself back. She looked at me with a pleading expression.
Yeah, you're here for the ship.
Tension showed in his face. He wanted to shoot me, but he couldn't. If he shot me, he would lose the Starliner. Thanks to Ray Freeman's opening gambit, shooting three Marines, then tossing out the pin of a grenade, no one dared accuse us of bluffing.
I could kill you.
Mad Dog, you wouldn't even be a warm-up. Why don't you put me in touch with the officer in command?
I'm gonna pull your brains out through your ass.
You know, you do a lot more talking than thinking. There is at least one man on that ship holding live grenades. Unless you want to set up permanent residence on Delphi, little man, I suggest you lower that specking gun and get me your commanding officer.
Eyes still fixed on mine, the Marine lowered his rifle again.
You want to speak to the man in command? I'll get him for you. But you won't like him. You won't like the general, but he might have some fun with you.
The Marine replaced his helmet so he could use the comlink. I was glad not to see his face. It took the edge off the situation. I looked over at Caleb.
Go to your mother.
Without saying a word, the boy ran over to his mother and they hugged. The Marine removed his helmet.
Okay. General Lee says he will come down.
General Lee? Would that be General Vince Lee?
The general thought you might recognize the name, Harris. He also says, you better have a damn good reason for being here.
The three of us, Ray, Archie, and I, met alone in the Starliner. Either Ray or I had to remain in the ship at all times. With their satellites and observation equipment, the crew of that battleship could watch us closely, and they might yet have commandos or snipers around our camp. As long as one of us remained on the ship, grenade in hand, they could not gas, rush, or shoot us.
We were better off before you came. I should have known better than to trust professional killers. I should have known you would start a war. All they want is your ship. I say you give it to them.
You think they'll take the ship and leave?
There's no reason for them to stay. There's no reason for them not to leave once we give them what they want.
How many people do you think they have up there on their carrier?
Couple of hundred.
Have you ever seen a carrier? Harris, how big is the crew on a UA carrier?
Full crew? 2,500.
A couple thousand. And how many people do you think could fit on this little ship?
A dozen, maybe two.
How long do you think it would take those Marines to fly a couple thousand men to wherever they want to go? 5 months? 6 months? That's assuming the broadcast engine holds up under the strain of extended use. What if it breaks? You saw that Marine. Do you think he would be able to repair it? Some of those Marines are gonna have to stay here for a long time. When half of them are gone, they won't even have enough of a crew to man their ship. Sooner or later, they're going to need to leave it. Do you think they're gonna make good neighbors? You think they're planning on sharing this planet or taking it?
I bet they are planning to share. Who's going to plant the crops and grow the food? Those clones are programmed for combat, not farming.
So after 6 months of servitude, we would be free. Our lives for 6 months as slaves. That sounds like a fair trade.
You think they'll behave themselves for the 6 months? They're clones. They're the ones with the guns. You can bet that the commanding officers will be the first to go. So the enlisted men will be in control. They're sterile, not impotent.
Harris means that they're going to be rapes.
Copulate, not populate. It's a Marine Corps motto.
And you think you can get them to leave without giving up your ship? They may just decide that if they can't have your ship, neither should anybody else. They may decide to simply kill us all.
They won't. They need the ship whole. They would have mowed us down last night.
They need the Starliner. You and your congregation may want to stay here for the rest of your life, but they don't. The only reason they haven't attacked so far is this ship. Do you really want to hand over our only bargaining chip?
So what do we do? We can't fight them.
Let's see what the commanding officer has to say. Then we can talk about the next steps.
You know the commanding officer? This General Lee? Is he a reasonable man?
Lee was my best friend when I was in the Corps.
Are you still on good terms with him?
The last time I saw Vince, we were on fine terms. He thought I died in action a few days later, so he probably considers me absent without leave and a traitor to the Marine Corps.
That's bad news.
Vince doesn't think much of your son, either. The last time they met, Ray paid Vince $20 to put on my combat armor.
I don't understand.
Ray told him he wanted to play a joke on a mutual friend by having me wear somebody else's combat armor. Only it wasn't a friend, it was an assassin. There was a man hoping to shoot me. Ray used Vince as a decoy while we snuck into a building and caught the bastard.
But you didn't step out of the ship when those Marines were here, Raymond. He won't know you are a part of this.
Freeman pointed to the cola-colored skin on the back of his hand.
He'll figure it out.
Most of the day passed, and we still had not seen Vince Lee. He may have thought that making us wait would give him a psychological advantage. That was what I thought he had in mind, until I saw Lee in person. His invasion force had come in the dead of night. It was early evening when Lee's transport first appeared in the sky. By that time, many of the congregation had given up on him. The women toiled in an already cleared field with hoes. Men cut down trees with saws and axes. Ray's mother, a woman in her late 50s with long pearly hair, taught the children math, reading, and religion by the dregs of the bonfire. I was in the cockpit, mulling over my options and feeling guilty about relaxing while everyone else toiled. When I glanced over at the navigational computer, I spotted the transport.
He's coming. One ship, headed straight for us.
Think he'll be reasonable?
Archie would love Vince Lee. Lee was the most anti-synthetic clone I've ever met. I think he suspected he was a clone. He protected himself from the death reflex by hating other clones.
Any chance we could say, Lee, you're a clone, and kill him off?
Maybe we could start a chain reaction?
I was only half joking. This idea might have had a shot at working. If we could convince enough of Vince's Marines that they were clones, maybe we could start a mass death reflex. If one clone believed, maybe they all would. The glands in their brains would secrete their deadly hormone, and the whole crew might die. Maybe we did have a weapon, if enough of them were watching. 1 minute later, a silver-gray speck appeared in the blue, cloudless sky. For a moment, it looked like an apparition, perhaps the sun reflecting off of a cloud. The transport continued to drop. When we first saw it, the ship may have been 20 miles up and far off in the icy blue horizon. It dropped out of the sky and flew over the forest, and then seemed to float over the camp. All work stopped. The men and women dropped what they were doing and gathered in a group. I ran down the hatch and gathered Marianne and Caleb.
Wait on the ship. You'll be safer there.
Without saying a word, she nodded and turned to the Starliner. Her hands remained on Caleb's shoulders. She kept her hands on him as they ran to the ship. I rushed through the crowd and found Archie and his wife.
You better come with me.
The transport landed in a field in which some women had been planting seeds. I returned to the Starliner and sent Archie and his wife, Marianne, and Caleb into the very back of the passenger cabin. Turning the other way, I joined Ray in the cockpit to watch. The rear hatch of the transport opened. Out came 8 Marines in blood-red combat armor. Government-issue combat armor came in one color, camouflage green. The red armor made no sense. They must have painted it red, but why? Then I remembered the Mogats during the battle for Little Man. They had worn red armor. Lee was emulating the superior forces. Someone had stenciled "The King of Clones" in gold letters above the ramp that led out of the kettle. I watched this from inside the cockpit with Ray Freeman.
Guess he figured out he's a clone.
You ever get tired of being wrong?
The 8 men in the red combat gear formed lines on either side of the ramp, their M27s held tight across their chests. Next came the entourage, 20 men in officer uniforms, who formed a line at the base of the ramp. As far as I knew, only 7 clones had ever been bootstrapped to officer status, and only one of them served in the Scutum Crux fleet. But here they were, 20 men with the exact same face, skin, and hair, standing in a perfect row, all dressed as officers. Last came Vince Lee, dressed in a general's uniform. He could not have been a general, of course. He stood at the top of the ramp, his bottom lip pursed, his eyes squinting, and surveyed the lines of men before him. Then, walking in a slow, magisterial gait, Lee proceeded down the ramp. One of the men in Lee's honor guard climbed into the Starliner. Freeman and I went into the cabin.
General on deck!
Freeman shot him. His body slid down the ramp and landed just about where the other 3 bodies had landed.
I don't remember inviting anyone to come aboard.
Lee smiled, nodded to his guard, and started up the ramp.
Permission to come aboard?
You know what, Lee? I think I'll meet you down there. I could use a little fresh air.
Archie, you want to come with me?
He nodded, and we headed down the ramp. The Vince Lee I knew would never have let his hair grow beyond regulation. He was the ideal image of a Marine with his powerful physique. The man was fanatical about bodybuilding, and not just bodybuilding, but old-style weightlifting. As Archie and I came down the ramp, I saw the new Vince Lee. This man had hair over the tops of his ears. He had the same glassy-eyed look as the Marine who led the raid. He also had the same recently starved look about his face. His skin was sallow. He had large, dark pockets under the eyes. He also had a few days' stubble on his cheeks.
Hello, Wason. You're looking good for a dead guy.
General Lee?
Let's see. 2 years back, I heard you died. A couple of weeks ago, somebody told me that you'd made colonel. I also heard you went AWOL. And here you are, alive and well, and trespassing on Unified Authority territory out of uniform. Good men died defending this planet. Give me your ship, and we'll forget you were here.
You'll just fly off and pretend you never saw me?
Yeah, something like that.
What does King of Clones mean?
You noticed that, did you? I'm glad. I wanted to make sure that you saw it, too. Let's go for a walk, Wason. How's that sound?
You mind if Archie comes along?
Just you and me.
Isn't that how they used to kill political prisoners? They take them out in the woods and shoot them. You still have a transport filled with Marines out there, don't you?
I guess I do.
I turned to look at Archie.
It might be safer if you wait in the ship.
He nodded.
Lock it up until I come back.
Glad to see that we trust each other, old friend.
Semper Fi, Marine.
We crossed into the woods. These were not the same woods we had marched through before the great battle, but they had the same tall trees. Scattered rays of light penetrated the canopy of leaves and needles 40 feet above us. The woods were dark and shadowy, and the light formed distinct shafts that slanted here and there.
What happened? One moment I heard there was a big naval battle near Earth. I heard they sent their entire fleet, but I figured the Doctrinaire would take care of all that. Then the network went dark.
That just about describes the whole fight. The Doctrinaire broadcast it in, and the Mogats zapped it. They sent some ships to shoot the Mars broadcast discs, and the network went dark, just like you said. Vince, I was there. Huang sent me to infiltrate their fleet, and they caught me. I was in the brig on Halverson's command ship.
Halverson? Rear Admiral Halverson?
He was the one who killed Kleiber. He defected.
Shit. What happens if somebody starts up the Mars broadcast station again? Will the Unified Authority come back to life?
You make it sound so easy. The Confederates have their whole fleet there, last I heard. That was over 500 ships. I haven't seen the station, but I'm guessing that they destroyed the discs. That would be a hell of a build job. You'd have to start from scratch.
Sounds grim. Halverson defected. I served under him. Can't believe he would do that. No wonder they beat us. He and Kleiber wrote out the whole playbook together.
So, what does King of Clones mean?
You, of all people, should not have to ask.
You mean it's me?
Well, it was you. Now it's me. Now I am the King of the Clones. You might have been the greatest hero the Corps ever knew. I mean, the battle on Little Man and Hubble and... when you killed that seal clone in Hawaii, I think that was the best one. The only problem is that except for us, no one ever heard about it. You know what was even better than that, Wason? Remember how you found out you were a clone and it didn't even faze you? God, I envied you. You were the specking perfect Marine. Nothing could kill you. Nothing could stop you. Not even the goddamn death reflex. Me, I was just another general issue clone. You were a specking liberator. Yeah. I know I'm a clone. Everyone on my ship is a clone. It's the only all-clone crew in the history of Unified Authority.
Well, what about the...
the death reflex? Interesting thing. Once the network went dark, the natural-borns began to panic. I don't know if you knew this, but I always sort of suspected I was a clone.
I knew.
The officers were in a panic. You remember Captain Pollard? You met him on the way to Ravenwood. Remember, that was the place where you supposedly died? Pollard really lost it. He parked our ship next to that broadcast station, and he wanted to just sit there until it switched on again. I told him he was dreaming. That thing wasn't ever coming back online. We waited and waited and waited, Everyone could tell that it wasn't coming back. At least the clones could. Pollard said I became worse every day.
Worse?
He used the word unhinged.
Because of the waiting?
Because I could tell that the friggin' Unified Authority was gone. I could feel it. And we were going to wait there until the goddamn Grant was nothing but a box of bones. So Pollard makes me take some medicine for the stress. He gives me this serotonin inhibitor. And you know what happens?
No.
I look in the mirror and see a guy with brown hair and brown eyes. And I figured, damn, I'm just like you now. And if I'm going to be like you, I need to be able to take over in a bad situation. I was going to have to lock the officers up, but if I locked up the officers, sooner or later the enlisted men would figure out that the only people not locked up were clones.
Not unless you told them. They never figured out that they were clones when they were in the orphanage. If that wasn't enough to show them, I would think they'd never figure it out.
That's true! So I took a bunch of clone sailors to the sick bay, and I had them try the same medicine I was on. Know what happened? Give a swabby enough serotonin inhibitor, and nothing happens when you tell him he's a clone. You get it? You lewd them up, get them stoned out of their specking minds so that they don't get stressed out about anything, and there's no death reflex. It's pretty speckin' obvious. My entire crew is on some drug called Falzude. The joke around the ship is that they're so friggin' stoned they wouldn't care if their dick falls off. The only problem is that they're not supposed to take it for more than 3 days straight. I've been on it for 9 days.
What happened to Pollard?
I had him arrested, of course. Once we started taking Falzude, we sort of restructured the chain of command. We were in charge, and we didn't need natural-born officers screwing with us, so we put them in the brig.
Is he still in the brig?
No. You saw to that. Once we spotted you in space, the officers decided to break loose, so we had to kill them.
You killed them? In their cells? Unarmed officers could not possibly break out of those cells.
I never really thought about it. I sent a platoon to take care of them, and that was the last I heard of it.
Lee turned and started back in the direction we had come from.
So, what do you say, Wason? Are you going to give me your self-broadcasting ship?
Can I have a couple of days to consider my options?
Sure. But if you so much as power your engines, I'll blow that specking ship of yours into the next galaxy. Do we have a deal?
I had that ridiculous combat knife, two M27s, and a particle beam pistol. Ray had one pistol that fired bullets, and another that fired a particle beam, assorted knives, and an oversized particle beam cannon, a sniper rifle, and a satchel filled with grenades. Of course, if the battle went right, we could pick up more weapons as we went along.
If they're still living by the book, they're looting up in the morning. I think that was why it took Lee so long to come down. He had to take his Falzude, then wait for his brains to unscramble.
We were holding an emergency conference in the Starliner, the closest thing we had to a war room. Archie and the three elders sat in the front row of the Starliner.
Falzude? You ever heard of that drug?
Archie looked at Ray whenever he asked questions. So did most of the other men in the cabin. Ray and I were in the cockpit leading this huddle. Ray shook his head.
Vince said it was a serotonin inhibitor. I'm no doctor, but if he's taking it to stop the death reflex, then Falzude is some kind of relaxation drug.
And you think the drug leaves him weak?
I'm guessing that the drug leaves him limp. We wait until they're strung out, and then we attack.
You've got to be joking. How many men are on that ship?
That ship is the Grant. It is a UA fighter carrier, fully staffed. It has 2,500 men, one-fifth of whom are officers. All but one of those officers are dead. That leaves us with 1,995, give or take a few. To have narrowed the odds down that far before even getting started, well, I'm feeling pretty confident.
No one responded.
Do you have a plan?
I saw the transport that the Marines came in on last night. It's a couple of miles away through that forest. I suggest we slip in and spy on the transport tomorrow morning. We wait until we are sure they've looted up.
And kill them.
We kill them, or they kill us. Sometimes those are your only choices.
Levi and Simeon killed thousands of Hivites in a single day. They did it just like Raymond and Mr. Harris have suggested.
I did not know the story, but everyone in the congregation apparently did. Whether it was Archie's story or just his support, the tenor of the meeting changed. The elders nodded. It was late at night by the time we adjourned. Stars twinkled in the sky. A distant moon showed in the darkness.
Do you think one of those stars is their battleship?
Marianne, Caleb, and I all sat on a large boulder overlooking the river. She had her hands wrapped around my bicep.
It's 1,000 miles away. You might not even spot it with a telescope. It's too small and too far away.
Are you scared?
No. Oh, yes. Yes, I'm scared. But this is not the first time I've been scared. And I don't think this is the most dangerous thing that I've ever done.
You have 7 guns and a knife. And you're going to attack 40 Marines in combat armor. I'd be scared.
Shh. Someone could be listening out there.
You ever heard of David and Goliath?
Yes, I've heard of David and Goliath. Goliath was the giant, and David was the shepherd king.
It's from the Bible.
So I hear.
Just making sure.
Christ is from the Bible, too. I've heard of him as well.
Anyway, you guys going against those Marines, that's kind of like David fighting Goliath.
I wish it was that easy.
Easy? Goliath could have killed any man.
You've got it all wrong. King David was never in danger. Every Goliath has a weakness. David just knew what it was.
He knew Goliath's weakness. Man, that's smart.
A few minutes later, Marianne took Caleb to sleep in the Starliner. Archie was in the ship. He was the man with the grenade, just in case Lee's men came before we got to them. I sat alone on the riverbank, thinking about Marianne. I imagined taking off her clothes and feeling her warm body. I imagined her lying down with her long hair forming a sheet beneath her back. My body responded to the fantasy. When Marianne returned, she walked slowly. I could see her clearly in the moonlight. Her skin was smooth. Her eyes remained on mine. She seemed to catch the moonlight in her hair. Without saying a word, she sat beside me and pressed her mouth against mine.
Please.
I could have had her on that night. Instead, I stood to leave.
I love you, but I cannot do this. I cannot stay on this planet, and you're looking for someone who will stay.
It's all right, Wason. I know, and I understand.
I could have made love to her that night. I should have made love to her that night. As things turned out, we would never make love. Ray Freeman crawled forward on his stomach, brought up his sniper scope, and checked on the guards. The scope had night for day vision and powerful magnification. The guards were 300 yards away, but that hardly mattered. Using Freeman's scope, I could have counted the hairs on their heads. Of the 23 combat-aged men in the colony, we only brought 20 with us. One was too scared. We left 2 to guard the camp in case we never returned.
Have a look at this.
2 Marines guarded the clearing, sitting on a log. They did not have a fire. They did not need one. The night-for-day lenses in their helmets gave them better vision than a fire could ever offer. The ventilation in their bodysuits kept their environment a comfortable 75 degrees. I lay down on the ground beside Freeman and shifted my weight so that I could peer through the scope. In the distance, the sun had just begun to rise, and that part of the sky was a rich blue. Behind the sentinels, the kettle door was open, and I could peer up the ramp and see the Marines milling about inside. White light blazed within the kettle. Most of the men inside it wore their body armor with their helmets off. Then I saw him, a man in a medic's uniform, walking around the kettle distributing plastic cups. The men drank the contents out of these cups, then crumbled them up.
This looks promising.
The medic walked out to the guards and handed them cups. They emptied the little cups like shot glasses, snapping their heads backwards and spilling the liquid into their mouths. I handed the rifle back to Freeman and knelt beside him.
Give the medicine a few minutes to take.
We could not use the particle beam pistols because we could not risk damaging the transport. That left us with my 2 M27s, Freeman's pistol, and my oversized combat knife. I thought about the knife that Hollywood Harris used in the battle for Little Man and smirked.
Get in position. I'll wait for your signal.
I nodded and took 5 men with me. I brought these elders along as scavengers. They would take weapons off the bodies that Ray and I left behind. We moved just inside the tree line, crouching, stealing behind thick trunks. When we stopped at one tree, the guards were no more than 50 feet away. They sat slumped on their fallen log. Their helmets were off, so I could see that they were not speaking to each other. I handed an M27 to one of the elders, a young man who would have looked athletic had he not been so skinny.
Wait here, behind this tree.
Moving slowly, I came within 20 feet of the guards. They sat on their makeshift bench, their eyes staring straight out without blinking. Their hands hung down by their sides. They were not comatose exactly, but they were strung out. One of them turned and looked in my direction. I was pretty well hidden between some ferns and a tree trunk. He would have seen me if he'd had his helmet on, and might have seen me anyway, but he showed no reaction. His brown eyes seemed unfocused, and his jaw hung open. I pointed my forefinger straight up in the air, then brought it down as if aiming a pistol and pointed at the guards. Freeman wasted no time. The first bullet tore through a guard's head, blowing off his ear and most of his forehead. The other guard fell a moment later. I ran to the transport. Hiding behind one of the doors at the base of the ramp, I knelt to think out my next move. The morning sun beat down. The men inside the kettle were not as dazed as the guards we had just killed. I signaled for Freeman to come. The elders came too. I did not want them to see this bloodbath. They looked so young. Most of them were in their 30s, but with their wide eyes and scared expressions, they looked young and vulnerable to me just the same.
Stay here.
The elders nodded.
I'll take the left, you take the right. We'll both start in the middle.
Freeman nodded. He took his pistol. We edged our way to the bottom of the ramp and ran up. There were 36 men on this transport. Most of the men did not even have their guns with them. Some of the Marines hid in the shadows. As I walked past one of the steel girder ribs, someone reached out and grabbed me by the shoulder and neck. I spun. And then it was over, and I never did use that damned knife. It was a one-minute storm that rained intensely and went away. I looked around the kettle with its bitter stew of dead Marines. The walls were covered with blood. The floor was littered with men in dark green armor. With all of the blood and flesh around them, they looked more like squashed insects than like men. The elders carried the bodies out of the ship. They worked in groups of two, holding the corpses by their feet and hands. They tossed the bodies into an untidy pile just outside the ship. My job was different. I was the grave robber. I mixed and matched armor from the dead guards, wiped away the blood, and put together a full combat suit. Ray climbed into the pilot's chair. The rest of the mission lasted only 4 minutes. I followed Ray up the ladder and into the cockpit. He had no trouble figuring out the controls. I heard the ramp doors closing. We performed a very smooth vertical takeoff.
That went well?
Did it look like the medicine was already wearing off?
Yeah. There are almost 2,000 men up there. It's not going to be this easy.
We need to go wholesale. Sabotage the ship and kill them all with one big bang.
Transport pilot, this is Grant. Fred, what the spec are you doing?
We were only halfway between the planet and the ship, but they had already spotted us. The sky around us had thinned. In a matter of seconds, we would leave the atmosphere.
Fred, respond. Transport pilot.
In the distance, I could see the Grant hovering in space like a great white moth. Radiant light from the atmosphere glowed on its underbelly. The top of the ship was lit by external lights. Beyond the ship, the textured blackness of space stretched in every direction.
Fred, your orders were to remain on Little Man. Come in.
Freeman and I exchanged glances. I went to the communications console. By this time, I had checked the virtual dog tag on the combat armor I took from the guard. I was now Private First Class Thomas Kane.
Grant Traffic Control, this is Kane. Our pilot is down. He got sick last night. We're bringing him in.
If Fred's sick, who's flying the transport? Fred's the only enlisted man on the Grant who knows how to fly a transport. Wason Harris. You never change.
Harris, your shields are up.
You're making this too easy, Wason. I pretty much decided I would have to take you out, but you're coming to me. Who ever heard of anybody raiding a carrier? And in an unarmed transport, Wason, that's great.
And that was when it happened. Flames burst out of several areas along the length of the Grant. The entire hull seemed to breathe in and out like a bellow. Then, the ship exploded. 20-foot fireballs ignited from the hull and extinguished in the vacuum of space. Pieces of the ship crumbled and flew off into space. The superstructure of the Grant never fell apart. The ship just seemed to turn off. The windows in the bridge went dark, and the ship listed slightly, then floated out of position. We landed the Kettle and hiked back through the woods. As expected, the Starliner was gone when we returned. The congregation assumed I had flown off in it. Upon seeing me, Marianne started a frantic search for Caleb. She found him out in the field. Only then did I understand. Archie must have listened when I taught Caleb how to broadcast a ship. Caleb said that Archie ordered him off the Starliner early that morning. It must have taken the old man a long time to program the location of the Grant into the computer. Once he did, he started up the ship. Around the camp, people compared Archie Freeman to Samson and said that he died a martyr. I don't think he saw it that way. He would have described himself as a shepherd protecting his fold, a bastard. But he had left me stranded on goddamn Little Man. Marianne and Caleb would adopt me, and I thought I could love them. But I was made for space, not farming. Ray, I thought, would have even more trouble adapting than me. He'd abandoned this life once before.
This is a short-range transport. It isn't made for long trips. It's going to take us a month just to reach the broadcast station if we reach it at all.
Even if we get there, this will probably be a one-way trip. You don't really think we can make it work.
Death in space? Well, the rest of my life stuck here on Delphi. I'll take my chances.
Less than 1 month had passed since our battle with the Grant, and he was already going stir-crazy. Dying out in space might have been easier for him. His plan was a shade shy of suicide. He wanted to fly this Navy transport out to the broadcast station. I had never seen a Kettle fly for more than a day, and we would be out for a full month. If we made it to the broadcast discs, Freeman hoped to strip the sending gear out of them and adapt it for this ship. The shuttle's engine produced enough energy for it. It generated joules and joules of energy for its shields. But this shuttle wasn't designed for the stresses of self-broadcasting. It did not even have tint shields. Even if we made it to the discs and somehow Ray adapted the broadcast equipment to work, it could all go wrong. I had first-hand knowledge about what happens when broadcasts go wrong.
Even if this works, we'll be lucky to get one flight with this.
I'm willing to risk it.
So was I. If it meant I could get back in the war. Rogue Clone, Book 2, is a graphic audio production. Published by arrangement with Richard Curtis Associates, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Copyright 2006, Stephen L. Kent. Production copyright 2012, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Ken Jackson, Elliot Dash, Gregory Gorton, Richard Rowan, Michael John Casey, Christopher Sheeran, James Lewis, David Coyne, Alexander Strain, Anastasia Wilson, Joe Brack, Danny Gavigan, Michael Glenn, Bradley Smith, Stephen Carpenter, Nick DePinto, Patrick Bussing, Tim Getman, Dexter Hamlet, Eric Messner, Jeff Allen, Evan Casey, Scott McCormick, Johan Detweiler, Tony Nam, Terrence Aselford, Pauline Delaney, Nanette Savard. Directed by Ken Jackson. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Sam Graventi. Additional music by Nathaniel Perry, Chris Rowan, and Brian Patton. The Rogue Clone theme was composed by Temeskin Woodman. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johan Detweiler. If you enjoyed Rogue Clone, be sure to look for the Vampire Earth series and Elizabeth Moon's Vata's War, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Available now in graphic audio.
Don't think I give a damn that you're my father.
The thought never crossed my mind.
I don't know you, and I don't want to know you. All you ever gave me was a rep to live up to. I done it too. Maybe I haven't killed as many men as the famous Frank Morgan, but my day's coming, old man. My day's coming.
Can Frank Morgan gun down his own flesh and blood? Find out in The Last Gunfighter number 23, Montana Gundown. Available now in graphic audio. Smoke Jensen's wife is shot. He will carve a bloody path through all of Colorado, leading straight to the heart of the villain. If you think you know violence, you ain't seen nothing yet. Don't miss The Visceral Revenge in The Mountain Man number 39. Assault of the Mountain Man. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.